Welcome to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Once again, complicated times require sophisticated techniques, literally sophisticated from the sophists. It's all war with words. It's all rhetoric storms out there. And so we're going to try to clean a little bit of that up. I'm Dr. Dan, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, rhetormedian, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. On the podcast, I do three things. I talk to comedians about their politics, and we do comedy. I convert conservatives when I can because the right worries me and I think they need to be worked upon. And I talk to anyone in this world of getting messages built into the people, which means persuasion professionals, cause havers, artists, academics, and of course, rhetoricians. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you're going to listen to today. That's an absolute guarantee fact. Today is a new feature. I'm going to start cultural studies interviews. I don't know. We'll figure out if that's the exact title or not. But my guest today is kind of my white whale guest. Like, I started this 9 months ago, I think. And I think I asked you the first week if you might want to jump in. And now he's going to be my 100th episode. So you're going full white whale. I Ahabbed him and here he is. So professor at Northern Arizona University. I've known him for a long time. He was one of my professors at University of South Florida when I was getting my PhD. He's in what is labeled the Creative Media and Film Department. So I got to figure that out. He films, he photographs, he makes music, he travels, he hikes, and he writes the Grand Master of the Grand Canyon, Mark Newman.
Hello, Dan.
Hey, man, you're the second guest in a row that had a hat.
Boy, I tell you something, I'm very honored to be at your 100th show.
Right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks.
Sounds like a faux accomplishment. Like that's there's some kind of status to that.
I put it on my report, my activity report.
Does that go towards tenure? You've already got tenure.
Yeah. I got the tenure, you know, but if there's ever any raises.
Oh, okay.
You know, that might sway them a little bit.
All right. Well, I'll send in my support for your raise. So yeah, man, you're in Arizona after being in Florida, after being in Utah, after being in Delaware, and Maine and Paris. And
yeah, I mean, I grew up in New England,
right.
You know, and then I went to graduate school in Salt Lake City. I did my master's and my I left for a year after my master's and then came back and did my PhD there. And then I went to the University of South Florida where I met you. And you came in that same year I did. We both came in at the same time.
Yeah. First year of the PhD program, right?
Yeah. And we worked together for 4 years. And then I wound up staying at the University of South Florida for 16 years.
Really? You were there that long?
Yeah. And then left and came.
Left in disgrace, in a blaze of infamy.
That's right.
We won't talk about that. We won't tell people what actually happened, other than you wanted to move to somewhere else.
Yeah. It was really great being at University of South Florida at that time. For a lot of reasons. One was, you know, just, I mean, meeting you, meeting Tim, meeting a lot of those people that were in that cohort, you know, that was like really just a fun time to be there together. And everybody kind of had, you know, you went off in different areas, different kinds of interests, but we all kind of had some, you know, common perspectives on things. I thought that, you know, and God, it was just fun.
Yeah, that was an interesting, because it was the start of the PhD. Art Bochner had moved down there with all of his, you know, status that he was trying to burn like a flaming bridge behind him and just started that program, right? And suddenly a place that had never had an academic tradition in the communication department other than a master's degree, suddenly had a PhD and they pulled you in and Payne and Bochner. And that little nucleus was a really interesting way to start a PhD program, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, when I was applying for jobs, when I was in the in the University of Utah, and I was applying for jobs. You know, I was writing my dissertation, you know, trying to figure out what was going to happen after I got my degree and where I would go. And then I saw the ad for the job. I mean, I was getting, you know, talk about negative status updates. I was like, nobody wanted what I was selling. You know, I mean, I was writing about tourism, you know, I was writing about visual culture, and doing ethnography, and, you know, and I was like, here's this job in Florida, Tampa, Florida, which, you know, I knew my father had been there once. That was the only person I knew that had ever been to Tampa. He had been there once in the, when he was in the military, because he had a sticker on his suitcase that was up in our attic that said Tampa on it, you know?
That's, I mean, great.
So, you know, but the job was a great job. It was written exactly for me. You know, I mean, it was like, they didn't know me, but it was one of those things where you just, you know, I just found the job and was like, wow, this is great. And, you know, one thing led to another, and wound up down there living in the tropics.
Well, what I found really interesting about you was I had come from UT Austin, which was this high-powered PhD program where I got my master's degree, and very elitist, very traditional within the field, and talked about everything outside of the things they did as if it was just bunk. And I ran into you, and suddenly that was the first time I'd gone through 2 years of academics and never even heard of cultural studies. And ran into you, and I'm like, oh, there's a whole set of answers over here that they didn't talk about at all in this program. And I kind of like these better.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know that was, and that was the way it was for me too. You know, like when I went to graduate school, you know, you have to write these essays that say why you want to go to graduate school. Like, what do you aim to accomplish? What are your ambitions? You know, and you know, I come from a working class family. I'm first generation college, let alone going to graduate school. This is all foreign territory to me, you know? And so, I mean, I remember like applying to these different jobs and having this one guy call up and say, are you quantitative or qualitative? You know, like starting my research, you know? And I didn't even know what either one was, you know? I mean, I had to go look it up and get back to him on that. And, you know, and so when I went to the University of Utah, I originally said, like, I wanted to study media effects and everything. And I, because I just thought it sounded right. Like, you know, right. That was like one of the issues that everybody knows, you know, television and violence, you know, I mean.
Yeah, that's bad. That sounds like a bad pair.
All that crap. Right. And so that's what I wrote, you know, on my essay. But when I got there, I discovered like the cultural and media studies, there was this whole interdisciplinary movement going on, had been going on for like 20 years. And I had some really great teachers, you know, that worked in that realm, and they were open, you know, they were open to my, the things that I wanted to do, you know, I mean, like, for example, I mean, as you know, because you and I shared this interest, I mean, you more so than me, but I was always fascinated by stand-up comedy. And, you know, and I wanted to write a master's thesis about stand-up comedy, you know. And so I went to L.A. I hung out in the clubs, you know.
Did you really? Why didn't I know this? Or did I forget this?
This was my master's thesis, you know, and... And they were really cool with it. You know, I mean, they were like, wow, this, you know, this kind of fits, this is performance. This is about culture, you know, and I learned a lot, you know, I mean, I really learned a lot in doing it because I had to do like historical research on where did this thing come from? You know, where did the comedian, the guy that stands on the stage, you know, by himself or herself, where does that come from? And kind of finding that and hanging out in clubs, you know, it was really fascinating to me.
Did you do coke with Pryor? Is that where the story's going to go? You did coke with Richard Pryor? Is that where the story's going to go? Like in comedy, when people do this story in stand-up, like it always ends, and I was doing coke with Pryor in the green room. That's perfect. If you're a stand-up right now, that's where this would end. I know. I was hanging out in the clubs and
what I was really doing was, God, I mean, because I didn't have any money, you know, I mean, I'd go to the Improv. What was the Improv? On Sunset Strip, I think.
Maybe no, Improv's on Melrose, and then
Melrose.
Comedy Store's on Sunset and Just for Laughs.
Okay. So I would go to, but I went to the Improv.
Or not Just for Laughs. What is it? Keep going. Laugh Factory.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would, you know, I would watch these shows. And the thing that was interesting to me is that, I mean, I really began to understand what improvisation was all about, because I would go to see the same act, you know, that would do a whole week there, you know, and I would, and so that would just basically unravel how improvisation works, you know, because I'd see the same set, I'd see the same show with different people in it, and I'd watch them, you know, work the crowd, you know, with the questions or with the hecklers, you know, and all that. And then when that was all over, I would take my Volkswagen bus and drive to the beach and camp in a parking lot and sleep in my car, you know, and then go back and do it again. I mean, it was like the best education you could have, right?
That's funny. You have hit some of the really strong, I think, ethnographer themes. The VW, living in the VW bus to do your ethnography, that's got to be, like, I'm surprised, like, Diane Fossey didn't have a VW bus with the gorillas. Like, she would go back to her VW every night to, was it Fossey? I don't know. Anyway. Seems like it fits within the ethnographic history so securely.
Well, you know, I didn't have to arrive on shore in a canoe, you know.
So, close enough, though.
Right, right, right. So, you know, like, just, and that was the same thing I did when I went to the Grand Canyon. You know, I lived in a VW bus. I had a couple of them during my graduate career, and camped out, you know, and it was a way you could afford to go to a place and for a long time.
Well, now, like, that's the big thing in the pandemic, right? Half the country, all the you know, people who have money losing their houses or dropping their houses and, you know, tricking out a van, and here we go, like, they're all living in their vans now.
Sprinters, you know, the sprinter vans everywhere. Watching them try to parallel park those things all over the country. Yeah, there's a lot of people that are doing it, you know, discovering the van life. And it's so interesting. It's like, it's one of those things that people think is new.
Right. You know?
And
It's been, how long has this been part of American tradition? I mean, all the way back to the stagecoaches and the covered wagons, that's really what they were, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, I mean, this idea of, you know, sleeping in the same place that you carry your stuff, and you know, moving all around the country. I mean, it's a great thing. I have friends that are doing it right now. And, you know, friends, colleagues at the university that retired, you know, and are buying them. And particularly for women, I think it's a way to feel safe, you know what I mean, to have that kind of space. And I also think, like, maybe, you know, Nomadland, that film, has kind of inspired some people to take that route.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Again, this, I said at the beginning of this, we could talk about a million different things. So I'm going to keep dragging you back until I get enough of what I want on one thing. So let's go all the way back. Let's finish South Florida. And then I want to talk about working class stuff, because we both came from the working class. And I think that's one of the reasons why we got along at South Florida, is the brutality of language and of relations and things like that is so different coming from the working class. And you're not offended by somebody being, you know, more brutal and things like that when they talk. And I think we shared that a lot. But I broke so much china with my, you know, cultural bull ways in academics early on. That was just when I first arrived at UT Austin. And I'd come from Kentucky, and, you know, 4 years in school in Ohio, I might as well have just walked into, you know, like, the feminists in the department were just like, why did you let this guy into our china shop? This is not what, so I had to learn quick. But so you have that working class background too, right? I mean, it's really different, I think, than when you get into higher academics, there's not that much of that. Coming into higher academics,
yeah, it's very true. You know, one of the predominant things that I remember experiencing at that time was the idea that you're a fraud, You know, I mean, there was nothing in my my background. I had two brothers that went to college, you know, that, but like I said, you know, we were first generation college. My father never finished high school and worked in a factory. And my mother was a clerk in another different factory. She had finished high school, but so the idea of going to college was like something we were supposed to do. But to make that next move, you know, to go on and think like, okay, I'm going to actually become a professor, you know, it was something that kind of happened. And going through graduate school, a lot of my experience was like, oh man, I don't think I'm supposed to be doing this. You know, there's none of my people here, you know, and you feel kind of schizophrenic. And I mean, so God, I've been doing this, you know, since 1982. That's when I was in graduate school. And that's a real, and it's only right now I'm kind of getting it.
It's only 40 years to get rid of that first 17 years of
this is my place now. you know, but the thing that's really good, like, I think one of the things that's really good is because you come from that background, you can, you know, and this is like sort of a comic thing, you know, a tradition of comedy, is that you get to be the debunker. You know, you get to be the person who is able to ask the question that kind of, you know, cuts through a bunch of the pretenses of class that you know, have occupied the university for so long. And I think it's different now. I mean, I think that there's more people like us now that have come up. You know, I mean, I find a lot of colleagues that I have, and the real advantage for me is that being able to see students, you know, because like here, we have a lot of first generation students, you know, that come, you know, that are coming to college. And so when you meet them, you can see them, you know, you can see the guy that you were, you know, walking in with, you know, with kind of wondering what's going to happen, you know, not sure if I'm going to buy all this stuff. And
yeah, I think that's interesting. Christine Kissinger is also the same, you know, come from that working class background. And I remember talking to her quite a bit when we were office mates, just about how, and she's interesting because she's so soft and precious on the outside. But if you just pull up the Pennsylvania working classness of her, she's also got this iron inside of her that's pretty familiar to me, like that kind of, oh yeah, these people are, they're not working nearly as hard as I know it takes to get through something. And I think that kind of training, at least coming from the working, I mean, it is the working class, and like that's your primary modality to survive and thrive in a environment. You're like, I can outwork everybody here. They don't really know what it feels like to go out at, you know, 7 a.m. Or I did a job once putting hot tar roof on a insane asylum in Somerset, Kentucky. And I had to be at the plant at 4:30 because they threw us all in a van and we had to drive an hour and a half or so to get down there. And then all day long put a hot tar roof. And I was the only guy who hadn't been convicted of a major felony on the crew. And that was my summer before I went to grad school. Like you were talking about writing the essays to get into grad school. That's literally what my answer was. Like, why do you go to grad school? You want to do? I'm like, I don't want to sit on a insane asylum roof in Somerset, Kentucky with 11 felons. Yeah, what are you guys? Why are you guys here?
right. Looking for a better way, man.
So, but I think a lot of the students do relate to that. I experienced the opposite of that. I taught at Southwestern here, which is a fairly elite, I think it's Baptist school, for 2 years. And the students and I never found common ground. Like before in public universities, I would find common ground with people who had no money, who were working, who were struggling to get, you know, all this stuff to jive so they could get through. And I always had a nice communion on that. But yeah, in the eliter schools, they didn't get me.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, too bad, you know, that, I mean, right now, I don't know what students are thinking about going to college. You know, it's expensive. In terms of there being jobs and stuff in kind of the fields that I teach in, you know, communication, media studies and all that stuff, those are very competitive worlds. And so like watching students come out, you know, like we have a lot of our students, you know, that do film. They want to be filmmakers or they want to work in the film industry, and just watching them have their, you know, their fantasies meet, you know, the reality of what that world is like is really tough.
You know? For sure.
I think it's going to happen. And for some of them, it does happen. But I think the ones that happens for are the ones that are really tenacious, you know, that they just aren't going to give up, and nobody's going to hand anybody anything. That's for sure. Right.
So yeah, you can't. I mean, literally in those fields, you can't hand somebody something because there are 500 other people involved who'll be like, why are you, what are you, you can't give it. No.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, it's all this sort of committee work, and everybody's aware of what everybody else is doing. And it's a really, I always found it a very interesting environment, but I kind of had, you know, one of the, I would say one of the super lasers that kind of cut through it all. Like if you can write comedy, and if you're an elite writer of comedy, you can always find stuff to do because they always need that. And there's a bunch of people that can kind of do comedy, but on every staff, like there was a guy, I used to rank my staffs, and there's one guy named, we called him Goldie. His name is Jonathan Goldblatt, but he was a better writer than me when I got there, and I knew it. And Jim Hanna was a better writer on Dennis Miller when I got there. I knew it. And so I immediately started to absorb those guys. Like, what do they do? You know, and I would learn it and learn it and learn it to where I could compete. But it's that sense of, you know, having some type of laser to cut through the entertainment industry. If you don't have that, it's a real tough slog.
Oh, sure. I know. I mean, you know, there's a woman that was a, she actually worked in one of my classes here. She was kind of like a TA, you know, for this big, large lecture class. And she had actually already had a master's degree from, I think, USC, in creative writing. And, she was really into like writing scripts and stuff. And I used to look, you know, at some of her early scripts and give her some feedback on it, but, she just kept at it. And, hey man, she wrote a series. Marvel picked it up, and it's coming out in December. And I'm really psyched
cool.
for her, you know, that has happened. I haven't seen her in a couple of years. You know, her family still lives in town, and I'm hoping she'll come back and maybe come in and talk to the, you know, some of the classes about what she's done. But it's amazing to me that, you know, she just stuck with it, moved to LA. She was like, you know, doing coverage on scripts for a while, and, you know, working other kinds of jobs. And then she got it. She got her chance.
Well, and I tell people there's no other place in the world where you can go and absorb those skills. That's what I was talking about. Like I had to get around better writers for me to get better. And you can't do that outside of that environment. Everybody wants to write their scripts or do their YouTube series. And I'm like, yeah, go hang out with people who've already done 100 of those things and have already, you know, learned all the mistakes, and you'll watch yourself just exponentially grow. But it's a tough thing because, you know, that's an apprenticeship type learning.
Right. Yeah.
And it's hard to get that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where else you would get it, you know, and I'm sure you get a lot more of it in the writer's room than you do in a creative writing class.
Oh yeah. Because it's this burner type of learning. It's not, here's an assignment, you've got 2 weeks, go sit by yourself. It's, hey, I need this by noon.
Yeah.
Right. Go, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
So it's a great environment for learning. I think it's one of the best environments I've ever been in for just, especially for people who like a lot, you know, a lot of stimulation, a lot of absorption, and can process that and then turn it back around and reflect it and use it. So it's much better than universities. Universities are so slow.
They sure are. They really are. And, you know, and more, it's like become very social. Like, you know, like one of the things that they're selling is that social experience, I think. You know, they're building new student centers and rec centers and workout rooms and all that stuff to try to attract them. I mean, the big game in town is retention. It's
well, come on, man. Would you rather sell booze, working out, sex, and friends, or, you know, a course in
right
ethnography? Which would you, if you're gonna, you know?
Yeah. The thing I have to say though is, like, since, you know, I didn't know, I mean, last year was tough teaching, you know, I mean, it was, they still had some face-to-face classes and stuff, but, you know, friends have come back and I think they really want to be back. They really want to be away from home. They want to be on campus. And most of them have been doing a really great job in terms of, like, you know, wearing masks in the classroom, which is what we're doing now. You know, everybody wears a mask in the classroom.
Like a character mask, like gorillas and Reagan.
Yeah. Full head. Yeah, right.
That would be better. I would think just everybody has to appear in full costume, like the masked singer. It's the masked student.
I know. It would be great. But that's going, you know, it's happening.
So did you see yourself, like, you always have always seemed like a hardcore academic to me. Like, I don't know if it was in the traditional identity that you saw yourself, but I thought it always fit you really well. Like, you're a guy that really likes to focus and hone in on something and get in and study it, you know, for your, you know, for interest, but you also want to teach it to other people. You want to write about it and make it into something. Like, tell people, like, I mean, just starting with, like, your Grand Canyon stuff, which to me was just such a huge project, which kind of fits the, you know, the subject. But the way you approached it, and, you know, I introduced you as the Grand Man of the Grand Canyon, because Grand Master, because that's how I knew you when I first got there. Everybody's like, he did what? He slept on the rim of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, you know, the what I was really interested in before I started on that was, I was interested in visual culture, you know, and by visual culture, I mean, like, how the world changed because of certain kinds of technologies and certain kinds of conditions that created, you know, ways of seeing, you know, that were either mediated by the camera, you know, or, you know, by painters who then their canvases became advertising. But, you know, kind of the structures for the ways that we perceive the world and see the world, that was my major interest. And so tourism became a kind of, you know, it became a metaphor for me to talk about modern life. And I originally had this idea, you know, of, you know, I was going to fire up my Volkswagen van and drive all around the country and study all these tourist sites, you know, and write about it. And my supervisory committee in graduate school said, that sounds like you're going to have a great time doing it, but you're just going to come back with a bunch of superficial studies, you know, because there's no way you can do all of that in the amount of time that you have. And so why don't you just pick one place? And since I was in Salt Lake City, you know, it's like, all right, I'm going to go to the Grand Canyon. That's huge. Everybody in the world knows about it. And so by going to a site that is about, you know, that is, like, sort of focused on the natural world, I was able to talk about the modern world, you know, and because of all of the baggage that we bring there. So the Grand Canyon became like an obsession to try to, like, sort of pull apart what went on there. How does this thing suddenly become a place, you know, in the middle of the 19th century that people from the East Coast want to go to check out, you know, and save themselves, basically redeem themselves, you know,
have a big, vast nothingness to dump my sins into. It'll suck all the sin right out of me and do this, you know.
And I'll be awestruck, you know, and I'll feel insignificant. And all of this became like a script. And it still is a script for the ways that people talk about that experience. And I have to admit, it is a very powerful experience. There's no question about that. But it's also one that is just like filled with all different kinds of cultural and social anxieties and threads of meaning that come from things like art, painting, sculpture, music. You know, people are trying to figure out how to talk about this thing, you know. And so it becomes like this sponge, you know, for all of this kind of cultural stuff. And then some of those stories stick. And that's really, I mean, I'm actually doing a project right now that's kind of interesting.
Back to the canyon?
Well, in a way. So there were these two brothers that at the turn of the century, at the end of the beginning of the 20th century, came out from Pennsylvania. They were the Kolb brothers, K-O-L-B, and Ellsworth and Emery Kolb, you know, and they were out there looking, you know, for work, trying to make something, you know, trying to make some money. And they wound up buying this photographer's tent, you know, and his camera gear, and with nothing. They didn't have any money. They wrote the photographer an IOU, okay. You know, and they went up to the rim.
I've done that to the whole world right now, by the way. There's an IOU on my wall over here. I owe you all.
I love the IOUs that people write on a piece of paper. You know, just like a scratch pad. So these guys went up there and they explored the canyon stuff. But the big thing that they did was they opened up a photography studio right on the rim. And so every day, you know, and this starts in like 1911, every day when the mule trains would take tourists down into the canyon, Emery Kolb would, make a photograph from the same spot, and he would photograph them, and they would ride the mule train down and then come back up. And by the time they got back up, he had run down to his darkroom, which was in the middle of the canyon at a place called Indian Gardens, but it had a spring, you know, it had water. So he had a darkroom there. He would develop the photo and make a bunch of prints, and he would come back up. And when they got back up, he would sell them these tourist photos. You know, so he did this every day for like 60 years.
Wow.
It made the same photograph, right? And so our library has these photos, all of them, you know, collected. And I've been looking through them. One, each one is different. It's like Smoke. You know that movie Smoke, where Harvey Keitel plays Augie?
I don't think I saw that movie.
Yeah, it's okay. So he's a cigar shop owner, you know, in Brooklyn. And every morning at exactly the same time, he goes out and he sets up his tripod and he makes the same photograph in front of his store of people walking by, you know. So there's this scene where he and this writer character that's played by William Hurt, you know, are sitting in are drinking beer one night, and Augie says, "Let me show you my project, you know, let me show you my life's work." And he brings out all of these photo albums, you know. And so the writer, he's going through them page after page, and he goes, "It's the same picture, it's all the same picture." And then Augie says, No, you gotta slow down, man. Yeah. You know, you gotta slow down. They're all different. You'll never get it, you know. And that's what these are like, you know. It's this panorama of time and history that's kind of reflected in the people that are sitting on these mules about to, you know, go down into the canyon. And so I've been going through these. I want to do an exhibit of these photos, you know, that sort of show a timeline. I want to make a short film about it too, because just these films, you know, just these photos, because I think it'll be really interesting to see them, you know, for people to see them and to see how time.
I just had a science fiction movie idea when you said that. So here's what happens. Somebody figures out how to clone people from their pictures. So you can bring them all back if you have a authentic, like daguerreotype, whatever picture of them that really captured the light, you know, in a very specific way. So that's, there you go. We can just bring them all back to life.
Right now.
That's amazing, man. All those, just that flow of images, right? But the Grand Canyon is so interesting because it's an unfillable symbol. You will never stop adding meaning to that place.
Oh, I know.
But it's already so packed and dense with meaning that you'll never unpack all the meaning that's there. And yet it's repetitive also. So a lot of it's the same meaning. It's just weird, deep location of symbology, right? And you've got to be one of the people that's got the deepest experience with that symbol on the planet.
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, I think I have looked at it.
Are you number one? Are you the most?
You know what happens is that because when I wrote my book about the Grand Canyon, I did not pay enough respect, I think, to all of those traditions. In fact, I was trying to unravel all of those traditions. And I live in the town now that's the gateway to the Grand Canyon. And I just have discovered how many books and writers there are, you know. But the thing that seems to sell is the idea is like in my book, what I call the official story of the Grand Canyon, you know, which is kind of like the sanctioned story by the Grand Canyon Trust and the National Park Service. You know, some of it's a story about geology and all that, you know.
Jesus started it, right? Didn't Jesus start the Grand Canyon?
Well, there's a group that does believe that. And I do talk about them.
Jesus gets in everything. You can't stop the Jesus.
Well, there's this creationist group, you know, that it's a bunch of actually, you know, quite well-respected, or they were well-respected geologists, you know what I mean, that go in and interpret the sedimentations, you know, in terms of the Great Flood.
That's awesome. That's great.
So I don't know, but I think if you don't like sort of uphold that same story, people are, you know, they don't want to hear it. They want to do the same thing over and over again. They want to be awestruck, you know. I mean, seeing they're eating their ice cream, doesn't it make you feel insignificant, you know?
Right.
Really, but I mean, climb into your Sprinter van afterwards. And
they haven't 2.0'd it yet, like zip line across the canyon or?
Not yet. And, you know, the thing was, is it wasn't... 1 Philippe Petit wanted to tightrope walk across it. He did the Twin Towers instead. Was that his first name, Philippe? You know, the tightrope walk?
I know exactly who you're talking about. I have not branded his name into my brain. So that guy, a French guy.
Yeah, there was a French guy. And then, but I think it was somebody else that wound up actually doing it, you know, and they don't, you know, because the national park is right on the border of the Navajo reservation. So the national park is never going to go for this, you know, setting up a tightrope. But on the Navajo reservation there, they did. And this guy walked across it. Walenda, I think
one of the Walendas.
Yeah. I think that was it.
That'd be tough being born into that family. And not really, you know, like you have a fear of heights, or you're like, we do what?
Yeah.
Do I have to?
Right. Wait, you want me to?
You're a Walenda.
Yeah.
Get up there.
That's right. Here's the special shoes. Here's your pole. Get going.
Yeah. Sometimes you just get the family. You just get the wrong family. We're going to go over the Niagara Falls and what? Your dad did it. Sorry. Well, it is fascinating. How often have you talked about this, like in podcasts or interviews and things like that? How much have you documented it outside of your lectures and your book?
You talked about
the Grand Canyon, just all your, like you are now a repository of the Grand Canyon. You're a child of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And that needs to be all extracted to add into, you know, the royal of that symbol.
I know. I've talked about it in places all over the world, actually, And that's been great, you know, but I've also moved on to some other things that, you know, really don't have much to do with the canyon at all. It's kind of like I went back to, you know, culture. I mean, when I finished doing the book about the Grand Canyon, I started going to Paris and I was teaching over in Paris and just in the summers, you know, and it was strange because the project that I got involved in there was a different kind of monument, which was Jim Morrison's grave.
Oh, yeah.
I started hanging out there and I was photographing portraits of tourists and thinking like, this is a very interesting cultural scene, you know, that people from all over the world that, you know, I just finished meeting people from all over the world who came to the Grand Canyon looking for meaning, you know, and now here was this little parcel of land in Père Lachaise Cemetery, you know,
interesting, yeah,
whose bones were, and they want to stand over, you know, Morrison's grave, and I mean, they come there from everywhere. And a big thing that happened, I think, that made people kind of renewed some interest in it was Stone's movie, Oliver Stone's movie, The Doors, where Val Kilmer plays Jim Morrison, you know, and so that came out in the early 90s, I think, and I was going there, you know, in the late 90s, and by then people, I think, were looking for Val Kilmer, you know. Val Kilmer's version of Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was great, you know, to go there and to just meet all of these people. And I have portraits, you know, I photographed them and interviewed them and did a radio piece with those interviews about people going to the grave. And there were people, you know, with all kinds of reasons for showing up there.
Well, I think it's interesting, again, from this idea of rhetoric, my ostensibly what the podcast is about these strong narratives and these strong, you know, constructions that you can't, in some ways you can't, you've got to do, if you're going to counter those, you have to come up with other narratives that are as engaging or that are constructed in a way that can compete. That master narrative, the strength of that master narrative, of no matter what it is, the culture has moved, you know, somehow en masse to tell that story about this thing. And they all want the phenomenological, the emotional experience of experiencing the story that they've been told. And that, it seems like they want that to feel real in the moment, right? And I think Morrison's the same thing, like the actual story of Jim Morrison, very different than that movie.
You know?
So which experience do they want when they go there? Are they looking for the more authentic Morrison, or is it the, you know, that kind of legendary mythic Kilmer Morrison?
Yeah. And the other part of it too, is like, and I've seen this in other places, but never so profoundly as I have in Paris, you know, when like he died on, I believe it was July 3rd. It's either his birthday or his death day. I can't remember which one, but anyway, July 3rd, I was always there, you know? And so what happens is that's when people start showing up, you know, hanging out at the grave in larger numbers. And then you get the people that actually kind of look like him.
Yeah.
You know, they know it.
Yeah. It's an identity slot, right?
Yeah. So like one guy will show up and he's dressed, you know, with the conscious shell belt, you know, and the blousy shirt, you know, and he's got his hair and he looks like Jim Morrison, you know, but then the next guy shows up. So there's all these Jim Morrisons, like, and they're looking at each other, you know, out the corner of their eye. And
damn it. Yeah.
I saw that.
I just became a joke.
Right. You know, all the guys that dress like Tom Waits showing up at the Tom Waits concert, you know.
That is so funny.
It is.
You know, it always interests me too, like when these small, weird, counter, like opposing or even uglifying narratives sneak in. I remember learning this about, I think it was Everest, it might have been Kilimanjaro. Like, if you're on dating sites here, like every 10 people you find on a dating site shows a picture of being at Machu Picchu. I'm like, yeah, I get it. You found, you know, the spiritual center. or doing her ayahuasca. I'm so tired of, like, they should just pump it into the Austin water supply at this point. I'm like, yeah, yeah, you saw some ancestors. But it was Everest or Kilimanjaro where, like, all the dead bodies are still there because they can't get them down. And, like, all the garbage and all the human waste and everything. I'm like, that's a very different idea of climbing the mountain as opposed to climbing this pristine, you know, white, you know, rock.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's, I think you're thinking of Mount Everest, actually. And that's where all those, they can't get them down. I mean, the dead that are up
you're
there.
You're climbing through the dead to the summit of the dead.
And, you know, and my stepson right now is very much into Mount Everest and climbing. We've been watching these shows, you know, like Everest Rescue.
Oh, like, did you watch, like, the crazy ones, like Free Solo and Manu or whatever it was, those climbing documentaries?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Yeah. Free Solo, you know, climbing El Capitan free without anything. That's huge.
Yeah.
But Everest, you know, they're lining up now to have their photo made at the top if they make it. John Krakauer's book, I thought, was really good, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of like unraveling how much people pay, you know, to go and how these things can turn south really quick because of weather or oxygen deprivation. Man, all of that stuff is very different from the notion of, like, I'm going to go up there and plant my little flag, you know, and I'm the only one up there. No way. Get in line, buddy, if you want to get your daughter. You know, that's the way it works now.
Oh, it's like my friends who talk about visiting the Sistine Chapel. It's like, yeah, I was in there for like 25 seconds in a herd that they were just moving through. And I was like, oh, look at that. Yeah, that was great.
Right. I was one time in Paris at Easter and they brought out the Crown of Thorns and they would have viewing hours like on Fridays during Lent where you can go up and you can kiss.
I can't imagine. The
Crown of Thorns. No, this is a trip, man. I didn't even know such a thing existed. And this was at Notre Dame, right? So you go in there and you get in line. And they're holding this and the Crown of Thorns is in this glass tube, you know, and it looks kind of like a bird's nest, but they're saying this is the real one.
That
you have these two bishops on either side, each one holding, you know, quite delicately the edge of the Crown of Thorns, and you come up and you want to see it, but the only way to see it is that you actually have to go through the ritual. So you have to kneel and, you know, you kiss it. I mean, in COVID times, this would never fly, you know, but you go up and then they wipe it off, you know, and the next person comes up and there it is, the real Crown of Thorns. So I would, you know, that was like my juxtaposition, you know, for the people that would make fun of you know, the folks that would go to see Jim Morrison's grave and light a cigarette, you know, and put one in the sand, you know, next to his headstone. And it's like, come on, man, you know, the Catholics are doing the same thing down the road. So yeah. Don't be judgmental.
Well, and again, as I try to do kind of education about rhetoric and the uses of language with the people, the regular people in the world, like everybody, you know, wants to sort of dilute it down to, well, you know, how do I sell my Cracker Jacks with this? And I'm like, okay, that's cool. But you try to bring it back into the depth of all the things you could actually look at with symbols and what symbols make human beings do, like that subjugation of everybody to finding the depth of meaning from the symbol that actually changes them or reaches into the dark recesses of their closed down heart. You know, it's insane the things that everybody's looking for. And that's the ayahuasca stuff. It's like, well, I can't get any feeling here, so I need to break down this. And I'm like, okay, all right. Everybody I know has done much of it. I'm like, yeah, you broke down some stuff. Not sure where you got to, but
I know. And I mean, you know, for me, for a long time, I was out chasing that thing, you know, and then I stopped. I mean, it just, you know, I just had to stop.
Yeah, you run around the track so many times, and suddenly you're like, you know, I don't think I'm going to catch that rabbit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think something's wrong here. That rabbit is much faster than I thought.
But maybe.
Maybe. Maybe it'll catch it next time. It's fascinating. And you've done so many cool things with these. You know, I think this is the nice thing about getting the education. And maybe it's part, again, coming from a tradition that doesn't really have a lot of deep theory like that and a lot of deep information. I know I always felt like going back to Kentucky and bringing this stuff back to them, like, hey, got all this great stuff that you don't have here in this community, but would, you know, electrify everything and really raise everything up. And so I've maintained the sense of wonder about learning and theory and all the stuff easily my whole life. Like, I don't ever have to reach to access the curiosity and the respect and kind of the awe for investigating and exploring these things and discovering things like what you're talking about with all these ways to experience these when you actually get there and watch it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things that because that notion of curiosity is one I really try to remind students about, you know, like, this is like what are you interested in? What do you really want? You know, just forget about like what you think you're supposed to do. What are you actually interested in? And their answers, you know, for those that can actually try to respond to that question, are fascinating to me. You know, I mean, anything from like, well, you know, I'm studying media and stuff, but I'm really interested in motorcycles, you know, or car racing or whatever. And I think one of the things that like formal education, especially graduate education, did for me anyway, was it gave me this vocabulary that at the time felt very empowering, you know, for talking about what was going on in culture or going on in, you know, like sociologically or culturally in a way of thinking and talking about questions, you know, pretty big questions about power and language and all of that. And that was very exciting to be able to possess that language, you know, only to go home at Thanksgiving or Christmas, you know, and to try this new language out on my family, you know, and to have my mother just like say, you know, who do you think you're talking to? You know, we're not stupid. You know, it's kind of like you save that stuff for whatever you do. We're proud of you. Don't get me wrong. We're proud of you. But we don't talk like that at the table.
It's that translation space. And I've inhabited this my whole life, too. I think once you get an education, you've come from this and you feel, you know, that liminal space, as you taught me way back in cultural studies. And that there's so much translation work in there to be done in a way that is respectful to these smart people who just haven't been exposed, haven't had the leisure time or the access to that set of information, and, you know, still giving service to the ideas themselves. And I run into this a lot, even when I do like the Converting Conservatives episodes on this podcast, and I'm talking to somebody that's gone over, you know, mentally into a fantastical world of dystopian politics. And I'm like, okay, so I've got three touch points that I want to put in your head. And you don't have to understand them, but simulacrum, it's all simulated media coming at you, right? It's all been interpreted for you. You're never there. You've never been to the border.
Right.
You've never seen, you never talked to an illegal immigrant. Never. Okay. So you have no direct experience, which means you can't rely on that information, because it's sketchy at best, ergo, don't draw strong conclusions. And if I can get that triangle there, just a little bit, just a faint trace of it, then that you just see a little bit of their head go, I could maybe think about that.
Yeah, yeah. It's true.
The simulacrum, that idea, I even use the word simulacrum, which I like to do to people. I'll give them one weird word, because they'll watch your head spin around. I'm like, I got you hooked now. And then you explain it to them. They want to dilute it and pull it away, but you keep bringing them back. If you can get that in there, you can do a lot of interesting work with people.
Oh yeah, I know. But it's getting him to that point, like you say. You know, I mean, one of the things that living in Arizona has allowed working at this university is I have a colleague, Robert Neustadt, who got me very interested and involved in taking students. He teaches a class on the border. I mean, just to use your example, you know. I asked him if I could work with him in this class, you know, and he does the lion's share of everything. So we teach this course, or we were teaching this course. It stopped when the pandemic came, but it was, and we would take students down to the border and we would do things like to try to give them a balanced view of what's going on there. They would be reading all semester. So we would go for like 5 days. And we would go to like, you know, a detention center, one of these corporate detention centers in Eloy, and let them show us what they're doing. We'd go to, you know, this, to a courtroom and watch 25 people get deported, you know, every 20 minutes. And then we would go over the border at Nogales and go in and meet people at humanitarian aid centers, you know, who were providing humanitarian service to people who had either just been deported or were about to try to make the trek into the United States. And then the last thing that we would do is we would go work with this group called No More Deaths. And No More Deaths is, you probably heard about No Más Muertes, is the group that, the humanitarian aid group that carries food and water and stashes it out in the desert on these routes, you know, where people are traveling from the border into the United States, not to do anything other than to provide.
I lost you there. Hold on.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah. So it was, you know, one of these things where, the idea of bringing food and water and providing these caches on these well-traveled routes across the desert, boy, does that give you a picture of what's going on down there? I mean, it's like kids, you know, kids are dying out there. And so to leave water and food for them so they might just survive, you know, and then what happens to them, you know what I mean? But the idea that you would provide some humanitarian in assistance is just so offensive to some people, to the point
about a water park. They just put a water slide.
Yeah.
Slide on into America.
Yeah. Right. It's a heavy world out there, man. It's very,
it is. So, but like, I tell people this all the time, there's humanistic narratives like that, like where you actually get their experience, you see what it really is. And then there's this kind of fiction where you're thinking about what it is. And then there's political versions. And if once you transcend up into politics, you're in a brand new game. And anything that can be, you know, nefarious and slandered is going to be. And that one right there, man, the what the right did with that is insane.
Oh God, it's incredible. It's just incredible, you know. And during the Trump years, I mean, we would also meet with the Border Patrol and have the Border Patrol show us what they're doing. And boy, you know, these kids were, the students that we brought down were smart and they asked really good questions and did not get substantial answers, you know? So I don't know.
That's fascinating. You've gotten into a lot of that sort of desert stuff, right? Since you've been in Flagstaff, you've done a bunch of that location as a, you know, all the things that tend to happen in those places.
Yeah. It's, you know, the other, like more locally, one of the big issues here is, you know, this legacy of the uranium mining that took place in the desert, you know, mostly on the Navajo Reservation, Hopi Reservation. And that is, wow, what a mess in terms of water and cleanup. You know, it's troubling. It's really troubling. And there are actually, you know, there's still a processing plant in operation in Utah. I went to go see it, you know. I mean, I was driving, my wife and I were driving back from Moab, and we stopped in to try to go and see what we could see. And it's pretty closed off, but they're still processing, you know, uranium.
Just those words, like, especially if you've watched something like Chernobyl and you hear those words. Like, I remember my son watching Chernobyl and asking me, was this real? I'm like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you just got to watch The Hills Have Eyes. You can see what could happen.
Yeah. That's one of the things interesting with comedy, because I've done a lot of things in the last few years, and this is kind of what I want to do in my next stage of things, of bringing big packets of information and merging them with stand-up. And it's just a different way to get people to access all this stuff. And even bringing like drama, you know, and crisis and tragedy in like that. It's interesting, like when it gets to be that level of human suffering, it's really hard to turn into comedy, I've noticed.
Yeah, I think, right.
You got to be really careful.
Yeah, right.
And yet, like when I do a stand-up show sometimes about politics, I'm like, the whole show is going to be about politics, and I'm not going to offend anybody because I agree with everybody on everything you say. And I'll ask who wants a wall at the border, you know, we raise our hands. I'm like, I agree. We need a wall and it needs to be 70 feet high. And you need, and you can for vacation, if you want, go down and be a sniper. And you can, you know, and we'll open up the gates and let people in at certain times. And they've got to run fast enough while you snipe them, you know, and the more you get, like you get a bounty, of course. And I go this whole thing, like, or we let no wall, we let get them all the way to San Antonio, but then there's these chutes and ladders. So like you may step on a trap door and be right back to Guadalajara. You don't know. So I do this whole thing. And like by taking their extreme and making it far more extreme, they can't handle it. Like, well, I don't want to shoot people. No. I'm like, well, yeah, you do. You don't care if they die in the desert. Would it be more fun to shoot them? You know, and if you can get it right, if you can get the angle correct where it's still funny and they see like, oh, I do have limits on the extremeness I want to bring to this cruelty, then, you know, you kind of do some work in there.
See, well, you certainly can, but that's a tough one, man. You know, I mean, it's like, I remember one time, you know, I was in Atlanta and at the Fox Theater, they were, they had the, and I went to go see this. It was, The Diary of Anne Frank as a ballet. It was just like, come on, man.
And, That's a tough one. That's tough.
And imagine the movement. You know, you had guys goose stepping.
That's a tough one. Yeah. Sometimes the art is pushed. You gotta really work it. Do you know Patrice O'Neill, the comedian?
No, I don't.
Oh, you've got to look up Patrice O'Neill. He's got a big legacy online. He died early, had severe obesity and died of a stroke with diabetes. But he has one of his specials called Elephant in the Room. And I use it as an example a lot of times when I teach stand-up, of just the essentializing power of stand-up. Like in 5 or 6 words, he took 1,000 people in an entire auditorium and they were just like, everybody was like, what? It just energized everything. he goes, ladies. And he's like 6'4", big black dude, super smart, so good with the audience. He's ladies, why can't I harass you? And you're just like, oh, here we go. Yeah. You know, and he has a perfectly logical, like, it's perfectly fine. Like, he's like, don't get me fired. You know, and just within that little thing of getting to that social issue in a way that you can talk about it, sort of explode it, maybe you can do some teaching in there. Oh, that's not essentially the, you know, function of comedy, but you can get a little in there. But I think of your stuff, and I think of when I used to sit on your classes and I was your TA, listen to you turn into narratives. Like, you would take these very complex issues like this and turn them into these really nicely paced narratives. And I always wanted you to be a story writer. You know, I know you've now moved over into music and things like that, but I always thought you just were so adept with turning this stuff into story.
I really do think that that's where people, how people learn best, you know, is like, those are the things that they pass down in the families, you know, but sort of the lessons of the stories, you know, or just the very fact that they they use the story as a moment where they say, you know, I witnessed this, you know, I have been through this thing, or I've seen this thing happen. And it opens up a way of talking about that with other people is really very powerful, you know, to take the abstraction and to put some flesh on it and, you know, put some voices to it and have it walk around, you know, and interact with other people. The story is the way to go, right?
That's what I say. Like, I turn it into stand-up. Stand-up's a very particular way of representing the world and looking at the world. Like, the thing about, you know, the getting across the desert to getting into America, you know, that could be an Ironman triathlon, right? You know, that's literally what they're doing. They're forcing themselves to run 100 miles as leisure. Yeah. Well, these people are trying to do it, you know, towards a different thing. So you could set that up like a Olympic event. You get 25 miles, we'll give you a year in the country. You know, if you make it all the way, then you get citizenship.
And who, you know, I mean, the circumstances that so many of these people come from, you know, we don't have any real strong ideas about that. And the reporting on it hasn't been that good.
Yeah. How do you break through with your stuff? Like, how do you actually get people to listen to that? Because that story you just told about the students going through this, that's how many students.
Yeah. And they go back and they tell other students, you know, about it. But it's a hard thing. I mean, my colleague, Bob, he's great because every night after we would do, like, we would like sleep in dorms and stuff, and we would camp out in order to be able to do this kind of a trip, you know, on a very shoestring budget. But every night, he would have like a debriefing, you know, because the emotional intensity of going through something like this, and people would talk about, like, just getting them to reflect on what they saw that day. What did they think about it? You know, ask questions of each other. It's almost it's necessary, you know, to be able to be, because it's extreme. And I tell you, man, by the end of the trip, when after you've hauled water and food out into the desert and have found pieces of clothing that people have left behind in these locations, what else could you possibly think about what people are doing? They are acting in desperation to keep their life, you know. How could you come away from that with anything other than compassion, right, for what they've experienced?
Well, I think when you do get that deep experience with it, that up close, visceral, lived experience, or even, like, I guess, a really well-told story that simulates that as best as you can, which is the nice thing of, like, you know, radio essays or audio essays and things like that, that can recreate when they're done really, really well. Then maybe people couldn't hang out with the political narrative. You know, there's too much visceral reality to deal with this abstract, you know, good and evil story and things like that. So again, that's one of the things I always admired about your work, is that sort of deepness of the narrative in it.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, there were some people, that I read very early on, where, you know, I think one of the things that can happen with pursuit of a graduate degree is that you can create this, you get this language that gives you this distance between other people, you know, and to me, that was always the wrong direction. Like, you wanted to try to close that, bring people in. And what everybody knows is, you know, how a story works, or, you know, in your case, how a joke works, right? I mean, like, you're an observer, right? I mean, that's what comedians are. That's what you are. That's what so many comedians are. And probably, you know, we go, you know, go back and look at, you know, Lenny Bruce and George Carlin, you know, as being, you know, real sort of central figures in that notion of observation and critique, right? Observation and critique, that is couched in entertainment and humor. But, man, you can't come away from those. I mean, Lenny Bruce, sort of, it sort of unraveled on him at the end, you know, But George Carlin, you know, right up to the end, Bill Hicks, I guess, would be another one, right? You know, as cultural and social observers, you know, sort of doing what you're calling the work, the teaching moment, right? In all of that. It's a very powerful arena to do that, because it's all Trojan horse stuff, right? You're smuggling in the really good ideas, right?
Yeah, it is fascinating. I think even with like Carlin at the end, Carlin became more of a, he got more and more bitter and more reporting than as much comedy. And so a lot of it in the last two or three specials, I'm like, yeah, he's still correct, but now he's really angry and bitter about it, instead of saying, what a bunch of, you know, yeah. And it's that balance, like you can't leave comedy. And that's what happened to Lenny Bruce. He left comedy and wanted to start telling you really the evil, you know, ugly things that have been done to him and all that. I'm like, yeah, we don't want to hear that. We want to hear it couched in the burrito. You can't get rid of the burrito, dude.
Yeah, when you're up there reading your transcripts from your court hearings, you know, I mean, it's really tough.
But I think you can do good work in so many different ways with things like this. And I, again, that was the original launching idea of Rhetoric Warriors. It really started with, I was talking to a buddy of mine in Fort Worth who I'd gone to college with, and he had one of the most gentle spirits I ever knew, very compassionate, had thought about becoming a priest, just a sweet person. And within, I hadn't seen him for years, and I stopped at his house after I dropped my daughter off at college up there and spent the night with he and his wife. About, an hour in, he just asked me, he goes, "So, Dan, what are your politics?" And I'm like, and I turned to his wife and I'm like, "He's been watching Fox News, right?" And she's like, "Yeah, all the time." I'm like, "Terry, you got to turn that off, buddy." I said, that's doing stuff to your brain. He's like, I'm like, "Well, what are you concerned about?" And he literally said, "The border, immigration." I'm like, "You're a white guy sitting in $1 million house in Fort Worth. You think they're coming for you? Like, have you ever, let's go right now." I said, "It's not that far a drive. We'll get in the car and we'll go down there. We'll spend a week and check it out." And he's like, "Why would I do that?" I'm like, "Cause you're concerned about it, right?"
Yeah.
And so I realized, you know, the so many people are being left to the devices of a certain rhetorical storm, and it's a super powerful one. And it's using techniques that go beyond ethical rhetoric and things like that, of, you know, this sort of, you know, production oriented brainwashing of using stings and lights and mesmerizing and all this stuff. You can literally look at it and go, "Oh, I see what's happening," but nobody's protecting this. And so I see things like with you a lot of times, I think that's what you are doing. You're rescuing a deeper narrative, more of the narrative, so people can have a more complex understanding of these things. And in some ways not be, you know, manipulated and pulled down into one interpretation that's probably not good for us.
Yeah, right. And I mean, and just like, even if you just do the smallest thing, like say, okay, I mean, you know, you've seen the buttons, they've been around forever, you know, like question authority, you know, that one. I mean, it's just sort of like, just to get them to the point of like, question the story, right? Just question the story. Teaching is a good vehicle for that in a lot of ways, because you get to throw stuff out there that will, you know, I remember teaching Death of a Salesman, right? You think students are going to think, "This sucks, man. This is like such an old story," you know, and but when you start to show them the interaction, you know, between the sons, you know, and the sons and the father, and the idea of aspirations that have gone unmet, you know, and lies within the family, the unspoken things, that stuff, everybody's got that, you know, and they come up to you after the, you know, like, "Hey, I thought I was going to really hate this, you know, but man, it kind of reminds me of my own years in high school," you know, that sort of stuff. And that's what the story does, right? That's what really good films do, is they just like open you up.
Well, in that space that you have standing next to those artifacts and those stories and those places of saying, "Hey, I'm going to help you rescue the ideas in here and the feelings and the universals," like it may have passed you by, the, you know, the arcaneness of that play, and it sounds like theater, it doesn't sound like a movie, it doesn't sound like the way they want to hear people talk. It's got that weird repetitiveness that they do in theater and overstating things. And like, yeah, all that's there, but get underneath the language and pull this other stuff out and then apply it to your life. And then there's all sorts going on there, you know? So right. I think that space that you have inhabited for what, how many years now? 40 years?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I know. It's wild.
Pretty cool.
Put it that way.
Well, and I've always been frustrated. And that's, again, one of the things I do on the podcast and why I wanted you on here is because I remember sitting in your classes and taking your classes and how much I got. But it's like you open up a window to 18 people, you know, and they're all looking through there. And, oh, that's a cool little window. And then after it just shuts again and nobody else gets to see it. And, you know, doing these podcasts, I think, is my way of showing, oh, yeah, this is what I saw through these windows. And you all need to see these windows, too. And record it so guys like you and Payne and all these other people I know don't just stay in just the small window.
I think what you're doing is great. I think that this is really cool. I mean, and I'm not just saying that because I get to be a guest on your show, you know what I mean?
I
just think, like, one of the things that I have always tried to encourage people to do in the media sense is like, hey man, you know, it is so easy now to create something like you've created, right? I mean, you don't really need any money to do it. People are interested in it. People are, people are looking for content, you know, they're looking for something that's different because there's so much of the same out there. And so to do a show like this, you know, or any kind of a podcast, you know, that kind of goes into some weird territory, you throw it out there, people are going to like it or they're going to hate it, you know, but at least if they listen to it, right, they have a chance to try something different. That's not coming out of the machine, the big machine.
Yeah. And the big machine, you know, this, again, the massive storm of entertainment, but then this is what I always got in grad school, why I love taking courses, is you go in and you're like, oh, this person has rescued all sorts of pieces of things. Like your readings were always amazing. And I'm like, I want that collection. This is boring. I've gone through it and the good parts I've already accessed and there's nothing left. There's a massive world of this stuff that people just haven't been shown. And it's amazing to me if you look at the amount of stuff you've done over the last 40 years, the lectures, the thoughts, the notes, the books, the videos, you know, that's a massive library of stuff that I know has value. And I want to, you know, do whatever I can to save that kind of stuff and show it to people.
That's cool. That's really cool. Thanks.
And then I'll turn it into comedy somehow.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, cool, man. We'll circle back around. You'll do another one before 200, or you'll do the 200. Okay. Maybe that's your thing. Every 100.
I would love to.
Because I want to talk about your other stuff that I haven't been around at all, like your music and the photography, and you evolved into that after I knew you. So I don't know anything about that at all.
Yeah. You know, it would be great to kind of tell you about the amateur film stuff I've been studying for a number of years too. I think to kind of get at things that you were just talking about, you know, like, you know, what's out there. Well, one of the things I really got interested in is the whole kind of everyday life study that comes through amateur film, you know, like 8mm films and stuff. You know, people always think about independent cinema as this thing that started in the 60s, you know, but actually people were getting hold of cameras, you know, in the 20s and 30s, and they were writing scripts and making films, silent films, you know, and recording everyday life. It's like time travel.
Yes,
it is. I mean, open that window.
Yeah, it's super cool. There's a guy here, really talented stand-up, who was also a lawyer, and I think he went into lawyering, but named John Ramsey, who was pitching a show for a while of him and his brother doing commentary on their home movies from growing up.
Yeah.
And they're both really funny and just talking about, yeah, this is what was happening here, and just adding all these layers to it and the stories that you would never see in the film, but that come in and off camera. And it was a super fun show. I don't know whatever happened to it, but I thought for a while somebody was going to pick it up and run it.
It's a great idea. Yeah. You know, it is. There was this, there's this group called the Center for Home Movies. And one of the things that they started was Home Movie Day. And I know you've got one in Austin. And people bring in home movies that they have in their garage or their basement or whatever. And nobody has projection equipment anymore. So home movie day is like, you get these archivists that actually have the gear and they project these things. And people, you know, are seeing stuff that's got family members in it when they were younger, that they have never seen before because it's on this film. And it's amazing, you know, I mean, from like very, you know, sort of micro histories and private stories of families to these huge cultural events that somebody recorded with a camera. I mean, it's not all the Zapruder film, obviously, you know, I mean, but.
We recreate that every year. Like we recreate the Kennedy assassination to celebrate it every year back at my home. Like one family member gets in one of those little toy cars and goes past and everybody else takes shots at them. That's how we celebrate the.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. I'm learning, man.
Well, cool. We'll talk and we'll figure out part two of this, because I would love to hear about all that stuff. Because I, like I said, I know you from a certain segment of your work, but this other stuff would be completely new to me. So I'd be fascinated to hear about it.
It'd be great. Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for doing it. I had fun for sure.
Me too.
All right, everybody. That's Mark Newman. Go take his class. Look in the small window at Flags and Flagstaff. We will see you next time on Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there and persuade people. They need it.